2-3 other hours that I was just there and playing doubles and having a lot of fun with the other kids. And we played hide and seek and played cards and Monopoly and all games. So we just spent our life at the courts, and I loved it. Nobody had to push me to go to the tennis courts and play ball. I felt like I had nothing to lose, honestly. So if I didn't play against them, and even like making some games of these top names and the players and winning in my first set, it was already like, you know, great because I was so young. I would say 80% was preparation. If I didn't know my opponent, we had a spy. The US Open or somewhere else, it was easier because at other events, people knew her as well. So no, preparation was a big factor in my game. Yes, definitely.
All right, we welcome you, everyone, to another edition of the Tennis Worthy podcast brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am Patrick McEnroe, proud to be the president of the Hall of Fame. So before the power era fully arrived in women's tennis, before you had the domination of one Serena Williams, before, remember this, before social media existed, there was this teenage chess master on a tennis court from Switzerland who saw the court and saw the shot, the games, the shots being made, maybe a few balls before the rest of the world, the youngest champion of her era, world number one as a teenager, doubles genius, rivalry magnet, retired young, went into the Hall of Fame and came back and dominated on the doubles court. The one and only Martina Hingis joins us on the podcast. Welcome, Martina.
Thank you, Patrick. You were quite decent yourself.
So. I was decent. That would be a good way to describe it. Here's where I want to start the discussion, Martina, if you don't mind, because people remember your incredible touch, your timing, your guile, the tennis IQ that you had as a teenager. But I think what they maybe forget looking back is all the pressure that was on your shoulders, right? When you're 16, 17, 18, number one in the world. So can we start there and sort of go back to that teenager who was a genius on the court, but had a lot to deal with off the court?
Well, honestly, I didn't look at it as pressure. First, I was like playing those big names, you know, like Steffi and Monica and all these people like who were ahead of me, like Gabby, you know, just like at lunch with her yesterday. So I was like, my first practices, we were like, you know, it's like just play well and be focused. And I felt like I had nothing to lose, honestly. So if I didn't play against them and even like making some games of these top names and the players and winning in my first set, it was already like, you know, great because I was so young. But later on, I think you get a lot more pressure when you're at the top already and you start to defend your title. So that was a lot more challenging, I would say.
Yeah, I used to hear the other Martina Navratilova talk about that a lot as she got older, and Chris Evert as well, two of the all-time greats, started to talk about as they got into their late 20s, 30s, maybe feeling even more pressure. When did you realize, Martina, that you saw the game differently from mere mortals?
When I came back, when I did my comeback at 25, I felt like, okay, I'm putting my name on the spot and kind of my brand and everything, you know, was I still up to it? Did I still have the game and make a point and win some matches? Like my first match when I stepped on court again, like in Brisbane, I was so nervous, you know. I never felt those butterflies as much ever in my first career when I just went on court that time. And, you know, I called home and I was like, you know, will I be good enough? So those questions arose much later. And when I started my career and when I served for the match point, I never felt like the other players. When I first time played, yeah, like Jana Novotna, who had a lot of lot to lose when she first played me, and she missed that first serve quite long. And the second was, I don't want to say like bottom of the net. I was like, how do these players, you know, that rank number 3-4 in the world, and it happens to them? And that's the first time I felt that same, that, you know, you kind of have to like, okay, how do I move my arms back? How do I make that toss? And all these questions, which were so normal and natural to me at that time when I played and came on tour, which started like, you started thinking a lot more, I would say.
Right. When I want to go back to before you went on the tour, though, because obviously your mom helped teach you. But I mean, I would say having a brother who's got pretty good hands too, that I'm sure there's some things that can't really be taught. So when was it that you realized as a youngster that you could kind of do things with your racket and the ball that most people could not do?
Well, I don't know if there was ever a thought. It's only because people were talking about it. For me, it was like normal. It was like, okay, I was to myself sometimes thinking, how could I not do that? Because I felt like it was not given. It was more when I started doing other sports and it didn't come as natural. And people were thinking, for example, I play golf, right? So when I first time I picked up a golf racket when I was in Saddlebrook, you know, bought the house there and went to the golf course, and everyone was saying like, oh, you know, you have so much touch and you play so great and, you know, your finesse and everything. And I couldn't, my short game was horrible and still is.
Golf's tricky, as we all know.
Actually,
that reminds me of something. Did you play other sports as a youngster in addition to tennis? Like, how old were you when you started playing tennis?
I was like 2. Apparently it happened on my birthday when a friend of my mom's told her, you know, she can walk, she can play, right? So so that's the day she started hitting some balls with me. And I mean, it was in the living room, probably just like tossing some balls, got me a racket. And, you know, back in the day, you still played wooden rackets, right? So she cut off a grip, got that racket going, made a grip for me, mini racket, and started hitting in the living room. And then obviously during her practices, she was a pro herself. Every time she finished or in between the breaks, she tossed some balls to me. And yeah, you can't call it tennis at that time. It was more like, okay, 5 minutes here and there, but maybe 5 to 10 times a day. So whenever there was free room for her as a professional, she tried to toss some balls to me. And at 3-4 was already more serious, I have to say that.
Right. You might get a kick out of this. I'll tell you one quick story. When I switched from the wood racket to the graphite racket, I think I was about 16. My brother was still playing with the wood. So he was probably 23, 24. And Lendl had just overtaken him as number one. And Lendl had switched to the graphite. John was still playing with the wood. And we went to practice one day. He was getting ready to go play a big tournament. And he kept missing his first serve. And I kept hitting the return past him on my return. And he got so pissed off. He said, give me that racket. Because he was using the wood, and I gave him, it was a Dunlop Max 200G, and he picked up the racket.
I remember that one. I mean, Steffi used to play that one.
Steffi played with that. So anyway, he took all my rackets, and he left for the tournament, and then he beat Lendl in the final, a fifth set tiebreaker.
Right?
There was the end of the wood racket. All right, let me ask you this, because being so young and obviously so mature from a tennis standpoint, you go out and you become number one. But how did that affect you, you know, just as a teenage girl? You know, obviously you had a whole different experience, but were there certain things that, you know, you feel looking back that you missed, that you wish maybe you could have done, even though you were playing, you know, tennis at a world-class level?
No, because I had a complete different childhood, but all the other kids had the same. So I grew up playing in a club close to Ostrava, actually, where Ivan Lendl is from. And it was like 60 kilometers. And so we were 40 kids running around the tennis court. So we had a great club life, 5 crazy parents who all wanted the same goal, you know, make their kids play good tennis and have a better chance for life, you know, through sports. Back in Czechoslovakia, who, you know, with sports, you could travel, you could get abroad. But I'm sure you've heard these stories many times from Martina. I even was named after her. So that was a chance for a better life and freedom. So, yeah, like all these kids I was looking up to, they were maybe number one or two in the country who were a little bit older. And yes, and some of them made it to the top 100. And yeah, with my mom and her perseverance and her patience that she had, and also being, I have to say, as a woman, sometimes also feeling like not only being the mother and the coach and being so tough. I mean, yes, she was straightforward, but also very giving and loving. So, and yeah, the practices were tough sometimes. And we had a group with other kids. So she was not only teaching me, but we had a group of up to 7-9 kids on 2 courts. And it was a great life. 2 hours of practice with her watching over it, but also like 2-3 other hours that I was just there and playing doubles and having a lot of fun with the other kids. And we played hide and seek and played cards and Monopoly and all games. So we just spent our life at the courts, and I loved it. Nobody had to push me to go to the tennis courts and play ball.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that, of having so that group of 7-8 kids. And then it was almost like you had free time. You had organized practice for a bit, and you had sort of free time on the tennis court, because there was a joy that you brought to the tennis court. You know, when you could see when you hit certain, you know, a little bit like Roger, you know, he hit the trick shots and all the fancy shots for the fans. It was like you really got an enjoyment out of just playing the game, it seemed.
Yes, and also we were giving the time because we were there. And every time, I mean, obviously 40 kids on 5 tennis courts, you have to fight for the court. So if somebody was ill or couldn't play, had other things to do, and a spot was open, it was a fight for your right, you know, to even make it on the tennis court. And I had a really good friend who was 5 years older, and we played against boys and other girls. And if I didn't play well, I mean, I would be fired in a way, you know. So, but I wanted to do well, and you know how kids are, you know, they're very real, and it's not too much diplomacy, and I wanted to be good and play well, and to be playing with her was a privilege.
Now you came, I talked already a little bit about, you know, how the power game started to come into women's tennis, especially around the time, you know, you were in your early 20s, but there was also kind of the modern celebrity. I mean, there's always been big celebrities as tennis players, but as, you know, social media started to kick into gear, you know, you there was a start of that as well. So did all of that feel for you as a top player in the world a bit overwhelming when you look back, or did you feel that at the time?
Well, I think the media was just different back in my day, that we had our spotlight in a different way. You know, me, the Williams sisters, you know, Jennifer, Monica, and Lindsay, and Anna Kournikova also was like, people wanted to see them, and just like ourselves, we were also wanted to, like, by the tournaments, and then you had to do media and photo shoots and all this. So it kind of existed, but not in the social media way, where I think it's kind of also helpful for a player that you can put your story out there or rectify things. So if the media, you know, puts, yeah, or just like say something that you think it's untrue, you can rectify. And I think it's a great tool today that you can give something of your privacy or even what you're doing and being out there, but you don't have to give everything, where before it was like always these questions and this and that, but you can put out your own story. And I loved the game, but it wasn't always my thing to every day, like the media sessions where we, back in the day, yeah, you had those 4 hours that you had to ace hours and for the tournament and all these things. But I enjoy just being on the court. That part, the show business, I know it's important, of course, the sponsors, and because of them, these tournaments exist and you have to do it. But I just wanted to play tennis. And of course, those photo shoots or some of the sponsor marketing things, I enjoyed as well because I didn't have to practice for 4 hours. We were just talking earlier, like Naomi Osaka's presence at the Met Gala was like, wow, you know, in my time, I would never be allowed to be in Rome, fly to New York, like to the Met Gala and come back and now being in the quarterfinals. That would be like insanity, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely changed. The world's changed a little bit. You know, I love the compare sometimes tennis to other sports, Martine, and basketball. I'm a big fan of basketball. When I think about you playing tennis, I almost think of you like a point guard. You know, you're setting people. That's part of what made you great at doubles. Would you say that your game was all about instinct, or how much was their preparation part of what you did too?
I would say 80% was preparation, how you go into the mat. If I didn't know my opponent, we had a spy, like Mario, had to go and watch, or my mom went out there. But sometimes, obviously, at the bigger events, the US Open or somewhere else, it was easier because at other events, people knew her as well. So we had to always kind of, you know, have somebody who went out there, because today is so easy. You have YouTube, you know, you can analyze the previous matches of your opponent, or especially the ones that you know you've played against already. That's easier analyzing because you know the strengths and weaknesses. But most of that, you try to speculate on what they do the best, but try to make your point and work with your strengths and weaknesses against that. So no, preparation was a big factor in my game. Yes, definitely.
When we talk about, you know, your tennis IQ, which is obviously very high, you had all the shots. Who would you say challenged your tennis IQ? That you, one of your, any of your rivals?
I think when I practice those Zetterberg battles with Jennifer, she was there was no exercise that she didn't know or couldn't adjust to. So that's like, for me, she was one of the players that could hit any shot as well. You know, if you ask her to do cross court down the line, hit a drop shot or shoulder, you know, some things, you couldn't surprise her. And that's, to me, something that you test every player all the time, even in the 5-minute warm up, what they're good at, what they don't react to. I'm sure you've done that yourself, you know, every time, or with youngsters. That's normal and typical. I mean, when I came on tour, Steffi and Gabby, they tested me, they challenged me, and they wanted to know my game. And that's the same thing you do in the five-minute warm-up. So you see how they react to a slice, to a fastball, to a spin, to all these things. But that's like, comes automatically, because I was taught that way since I was probably 5 years old. You know, I had, my mom always tried to have me play against amateurs who, like just a set, even when I was young, and it was a tall guy who came running, was attacking. So I had to play a short ball into the feet. And when he came closer, I had to lob. Then one who can run, one who had a weak back end for and whatever. So it was always strategy behind everything we did.
So Jennifer Capriati, of course, is who you're talking about. One of the first real power players. There was Lindsay Davenport, of course, as well. You've mentioned Steffi, who, in addition to having one of the greatest forehands of all time, was lightning fast. And then along comes Venus and, you know, Serena. And when they started to come on, they kind of like took it to another level, I think, from a strength standpoint, and certainly from the power quotient. When did you realize that, wow, like the game was sort of changing right in front of you?
Well, I was growing up with them. So in the beginning, it was a little bit of a wild game what they did, but they adjusted pretty quickly. So I think even like when I played one of the earlier matches against Venus and Serena, it was like I was, outlasting them with discipline and playing my game, that I was more consistent. Also, I always like to remember when people say about Serena that she has that power, but we had one of our only, actually the first one and only practice in Rome ahead of the tournament. And we played like, I don't know, 30 to 40 balls cross court, like through the middle, cross court forehand, cross court backhand. I think the first 10 to 15 minutes, we used probably 3 balls. So every time they go like and talk about like power with the Williams sisters, either Venus, I think Venus was probably more creative, but she could also be like mentally a little bit more fragile, where Serena was just like so headstrong and her willpower, and in big tight moments she could serve up an ace, which I hated, but I think, yeah, they knew the drills. So they could hit pretty much out of every position on the court as well. Especially after that practice, I was saying always like, yeah, Serena, she can hold the ball if she needs to. She can rally as well.
Yeah, she can rally and she could defend the court very well too.
Yeah.
In her prime, she was, you know, a great mover, a great defender. But the serve, I think, was certainly the X factor. So you obviously mentioned it at the top. You retired quite young. You came back. What was that process like for you? Was it burnout? Was it you just needed a break? Did you think you'd come back when you decided to retire initially? What was going through your head at that time?
Well, I was already 8 years on tour, and I had my second surgery on my ankle, which Yeah, I came back, but I didn't play the way I was playing before, or couldn't give it 100%. And it was a combination that I was kind of scared to run to the corners, and you could not do that anymore. I mean, especially it was the end of the year, and you play the US Open and the indoor events, I was losing to players that I wasn't supposed to lose. And I just said, okay, 70-80% is not enough anymore. And also back to that question, like against the, you know, the big hitters, the power players, it was harder for me to win back-to-back matches as well. You know, like you beat one Williams sister, the next one was waiting. So it was like, oh my God. You know, the only time I beat them back-to-back was in Australia, quarters and semis. But it was just like, you know, this chapter in the women's tennis in that time, it was just like physically, it was very challenging. And obviously at the end of the season when, you know, those injuries happen, you're tired, you're a little bit outlasted. And I needed a break. I didn't think it's going to take that long or whatever. In my back of my head, it was thinking, yeah, maybe take a break. And people were talking about, retirement. In my head, it wasn't like totally retirement. But at 25, obviously, 3 years later, I felt, okay, I tried now or never, you know. But yeah, it was also different, you know. It was also different. We all started so young. So at 22, yes, today they kind of start their game and they still talk about being a teenager. You're very young. But I talked to Lindsay at one point, when you didn't win a Grand Slam by the time you hit 20, you were like, okay, you're never going to win something, you know, anymore. And there she was like winning her Grand Slams at 22, right? So she had Jennifer, who was same age, who had won the Olympics and was already up there. So she was compared to her, obviously. And so it was a different outlook on women's game. I think in the men's game, everything is just the evolution of that. You can also play longer, but you start being better at a later age.
Yeah, obviously the top players now, generally speaking, are peaking. You know, they're not getting to their peak until their early 20s. The physicality of the game has changed a lot. All right, let's go back to when you decided to come back, and you came back and you just were just killing it in doubles for so many years. What was that decision like, and how much did you enjoy that part of your career?
Well, I enjoyed it, but it wasn't like I didn't think of coming back and play doubles. I was coaching Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova earlier for 3 months because I was training with them in Patrick Mouratoglou's academy. And I had five girls under my kind of supervision. I was like overlooking and was more of a consultant. And then I played some legends. I played team tennis, obviously. That was everybody's, you should come back. But I was like, no, I don't want to. And then I started practicing or coaching Sabine Lisicki in Australia. And up to the moment where it was Indian Wells, she was like, I want to play doubles as well before my singles. And I'm like, okay, great. Let's get you a partner. And she's like, well, no, I want to play with you. And I'm like, yeah, you're crazy. And I was like, yeah, I haven't played a serious match in 6 years. So no way. You know, it's like, yeah, let's go. You know, so I was practicing with her occasionally. So we played our first match against Barty Delacqua, who had one Grand Slam and made finals in the last three Grand Slams. So I'm like, great, number two doubles team in the world. Great draw. We actually won a set. We lost, ended up losing in the super tiebreaker, but I was like, okay, not too bad. You know, in the beginnings, I was like telling Sabine, please slow down. It's happening all too fast. But a couple of weeks later, we played in Miami, and I, in between those two events, I played a few matches in doubles. I trained for myself, and we ended up winning Miami, which was unbelievable. Yeah, quarterfinals, we probably, I don't know, 7-8 match points down, and we won that match. We won the title, and from the story began right there. But It wasn't mentioned, like, meant to be at that point. No.
Yeah, it sounds like it just kind of happened. It's funny because you were sort of doing what your mom had done when you were a little girl, like with a group of players. You were doing the same thing at Patrick's Academy. All right, I got a little rapid fire for you. I think you're going to enjoy this. Just quick, give me a quick answer, and I'm going to throw a few topics at you. Toughest competitor?
Serena.
Best volley?
Myself and Martina.
Okay.
I mean, women's game or men's or like everything. It's like.
Either way, it's up to you. It's your podcast. You do whatever you want. You're Martina Hingis.
Okay.
Okay.
So Martina, the two Martinas, let's say. Your brother was pretty good too. Yeah, John. I mean, I lost playing mixed doubles with him. We didn't lose a match.
There's a lot of feel on that court. All right. Smartest opponent you played against?
Yeah, I have to go instinctively and like again back to Jennifer, like the way she was a great thinker on the court and yeah, was able to play like from her guts. To me, Jennifer and Justine Henin also like pretty good because she wasn't as big and tall like myself, and yeah, she was like physically stronger. Like, and that's what she was like, that was, yeah, pretty good what she did out there, especially on clay.
Amazing. I mean, amazing what she did. All right. Player that you wish you played more.
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean,
it could be from another era. Could be maybe someone that, you know, from another era that you just wish you could have played. How about that?
Yeah, that's more easy to answer. I mean, I wish sometimes, like, you know, you don't have to compare, but because you never should compare champions, in my opinion. But I wish, you know, like I sometimes played the best players from that era, like in the best Martina against the best Martina or Chris Evert or even Billie Jean or, you know, Steffi. I wish I had another chance being able to play her after that, but she ran away with Andre, so didn't get the rematch. But
how about this one? Best doubles partner. I know you.
I was lucky enough to have great partners every time I played with whoever I did. I think they all had their great attributes. So with Anna was we had a lot of fun on and off the court. Kournikova, with Jana Novotná was completely different. You know, that was the only time probably like someone was also great at the net, you know, serve and volleyed. Most of the other players I played like with even later on was like Sanja Mirza, who had great ground strokes, one of the best forehands out there. Yeah, it was a lot of fun playing with Venus, that one match we did. I was like, you know, if your sister will let you go sometime, you know, on the men's side also, like Leander Paes was amazing, you know, what he was able to see and foresee at the net. Yeah, incredible. His hands.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah. What about the best dressed from the 90s? Who was the best dressed player you remember?
Yeah, I really like Gabri Sabatinis. Even when I was like a child, I always liked her outfits because it was like classic style. And I think Anna's outfits were quite sexy, and Serena and Venus' outfits, they were just like different out there, you know? So I don't know.
That's a good one.
Different combination.
All right. Give me the your favorite court in the world.
Rebound Ace, Australia, Melbourne, Centre Court. That's very easy.
It no longer exists anymore. They changed that years ago. Yeah, from the old ground.
Well, it exists in our indoor place. We have built that court everywhere.
We still have it there. All right, here's my final question. You could think about this one. We really appreciate you joining us here on the Tennis Worthy podcast for the Tennis Hall of Fame. If a Martina Hingis came along today at 16 years old, what advice would you give her?
Enjoy the ride. Enjoy the moment. Listen to your mom. because, you know, nothing lasts forever. And at that time, I was thinking like, yeah, you know, like I was very fortunate and in a way the game of tennis has given me so much. And as a teenager, you would think that all these things that I was able to see and vision and live, they last forever, which they don't. And at that time, you don't see it that way. So I wish with my knowledge and experience, to the younger Martina, like, take every day, don't take anything for granted, because it's not going to be there forever.
Yeah. Very, very sound advice. Sage, I should say. Very smart. And
yeah, well, because at 17, I was thinking like, all of this, I'll be winning everything all the time forever. And it's the others don't sleep. They want to bite you in the ass.
Well, you said it well. Tennis has given you a lot. But trust me when I tell you, on behalf of the Tennis Hall of Fame, you have given tennis so much, and we could see it all at the museum at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Martina Hingis, thank you so much for joining us here on the Tennis Worthy podcast.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.